Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA. From growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hello, and welcome to Japan Explained. This is the third and final episode of a mini-series about Japan's favorite hero, Saigo Takamori. We've already seen what Saigo is loved and respected for. He was decent, loyal, honest, brave, tried not to shed unnecessary blood, and was merciful to his enemies. Together with his friends, Saigo was able to destroy the more than 250-year-old Tokugawa shogunate and the much longer tradition of shogunal government itself, returning power to the Emperor of Japan. When the war that followed the fall of the shogunate was over, Saigo returned home to Kagoshima, and that is where we left him last time. This time, let's take a look at what Saigo did, aspired to, and dreamed of in the new era, and what he regretted or was angry about. And most importantly, what earned him the title of the last samurai, which still inspires not only the Japanese, but people all over the world. The last time we left Saigo, he had just returned to Satsuma to rest and recover his health in the Hinatayama hot springs in the north of the province. It is there that we find him in the early 1869. Between hunting, fishing, and relaxing in the hot springs, Saigo could go weeks or even months without appearing in Kagoshima. He showed no interest in national or provincial politics and even declined an invitation to join the new government. Saigo had hoped to be allowed to resign and live peacefully with his family on the islands. But by this time, Saigo had become a victim of his own popularity. Respected by allies and enemies alike, the samurai of Kagoshima, he was a hero whose participation in any endeavor instantly made it timely, important, and just. Therefore, when the situation in the province began to heat up, Daimyo Shimazu Tadayoshi personally came to Hinatayama to ask Saigo to return to service. Unable to refuse his lord's request, he was forced to accept the post of counselor. Formally, Saigo was now one of those responsible for a series of social reforms brought about by the discontent of lower-ranking samurai. A year earlier, Emperor Meiji had vowed that from now on, all classes of society would participate in the affairs of the state. But the government gave no clear deadlines, and the low-ranking samurai of Satsuma, who in recent years had become accustomed to being politically active and taking matters in their own hands, began to stage demonstrations demanding access to leadership positions. As their demands were based on the emperor's oath and ideologically aligned with the decrees of the new government, they were difficult to refuse. Situation began to escalate, and it was at this point that Saigo was appointed to his new post so that his presence would reassure the samurai that their interests would be respected. It was safe to stop the riots. Saigo's involvement in the reforms pretty much ended with this symbolic role. As usual, he found administrative work terribly boring and spent many days in Hinatayama, walking in the mountains with his dogs. In a letter to his friend in Oshima, Saigo would write, "At the time, I asked for leave, thinking I would retire. I did get permission for temporary leave, but then I was informed that I must serve in the Han government. There was nothing I could do about that. So, now I'll remain in service for at least another year or two. I had wanted to come to the island this spring, but now it seems that will be impossible." Within a few years, the reform would literally transform Satsuma. The incomes of the upper and lower ranks of samurai would be virtually equalized, the clan army would be restructured in English manner, the system of provincial administration and the method of appointment would be transformed, the tax system would be simplified, and modern industry would flourish. But it was the war in the north that attracted Saigo much more than any of these impressive changes. When imperial troops attacked the last stronghold of the military opposition at Hakodate on the island of Hokkaido in late June, Saigo raised troops and rushed to the rescue. But the rebels surrendered after only 7 days of fighting. By the time Saigo arrived on the scene, the war was over. Depressed and tired, he returned back to Kagoshima and hid from the world in the hot springs. Even the enormous imperial stipend of 2,000 koku did not make him happy. That was understandable, though. Saigo was seriously ill and feeling worse and worse. He could not retire and rest, nor could he die in battle. So he continued to be an indifferent symbol of reform at Satsuma. Yet, Saigo's popularity was not confined to Satsuma. He was a figure of national importance, and the politicians in Tokyo also needed his symbolic presence. On several occasions, they had tried to summon Saigo to Tokyo, but he had refused each time, so they had to resort to the ultimate solution. Knowing that Saigo could not refuse the imperial wishes, in February 1871, Iwakura Tomomi, a nobleman already known to you from the previous episode and his role in the overthrow of the shogunate, arrived in Kagoshima as the emperor's envoy and once again asked Saigo to return. Of course, Saigo could not say no to the emperor, so a few days later he agreed to go to Tokyo and serve the country as a member of the Meiji government. After all, like all former revolutionaries, he had his own vision of an ideal Japan after the fall of the shogunate. In Saigo's view, drawn from the Chinese books, laws and regulations were a good thing, but they were useless if they were enforced by weak and corrupt officials. So he wanted a clear and transparent system for evaluating officials that would promote the able and virtuous and dismiss the unworthy. No one in power should use it for their own benefit, Saigo believed, and he lived accordingly. And how unhappy he was when he saw what his colleagues were doing with the state's money. Equally strong was Saigo's belief that trying to imitate everything the West does will not bring any good. While Japan had much to learn from the West, he felt that the Meiji government should have been built on the traditional Japanese values, taking into account the interests of Japan and its people, rather than throwing money at some stupid nonsense like railways. Saigo also had his own ideas about the role of the peasantry in Japan's future, the place of religion in people's lives, and the revival of local customs and festivals. And it was with all these thoughts that Saigo arrived in Tokyo on the 22nd of March, 1871. However, his colleagues in the government knew him rather well, so they tasked him with something familiar and useful, and most importantly, something Saigo was really good at, recruiting and training troops, namely with the creation of the Imperial Guard, a matter on which all members of the new government were surprisingly unanimous. Less than 2 weeks after his arrival in the capital, Saigo headed back to Kagoshima. When the Imperial Guard, made of samurai from Satsuma, Choshu and Tosa, was finally formed some 2 months later, the new government felt ready to take the next dangerous step and announced the abolitions of clans, provinces and the hereditary power of the daimyo. Here, Kido no Kubo had to persuade Saigo to agree. And on one hand, Saigo agreed. A centralized administration was a great advantage in terms of defense, international affairs, and many other things. He also realized that his agreement would largely determine how peacefully the government's decision would be received. But on the other hand, he felt that he was betraying the Shimazu clan. When on the 28th of August, the emperor announced the abolition of the last remaining clans, including Satsuma, and the abolition of the daimyo's authority, Saigo wrote. When the imperial order was given, my personal feelings were difficult to endure, since I have, along with you, enjoyed the blessings of the Shimazu house for centuries. But this is the general course of the realm, and no matter what I say, I cannot defend against it for 10 years. I think this movement is something beyond human strength. Contrary to the expectations of the new government, there were particularly no discontented daimyo, except for Hisamitsu, who was never happy about anything since the beginning of the new era and always blamed Saigo and Okubo for everything that went wrong. Having established a system of centralized government and finally eliminating the threat of the daimyo, the major government set a new agenda. An overseas voyage to discover the best of Europe and America and establish diplomatic relations with civilized countries. And while Kido, Okubo, Iwakura and nearly 50 other men went on the journey, the nobleman Sanjo Sanetomi and Saigo were left to look after Japan as the heads of the provisional government. Before leaving, the members of the mission and the members of the provisional government agreed that they would not take any important action without consulting each other and that most reforms would be postponed until the mission returned. Saigo was not really thrilled with his position as a do-nothing overseer, but there was no one else to look after Japan, so he stayed and did what he could. On the 23rd of December, the Iwakura mission sailed from Yokohama for San Francisco, and Saigo stayed behind to watch as the politicians who remained in Japan tried to impose their ideas despite agreements not to do so and argued with each other over a tight budget. It was impossible to simply put the transformation of a newly reborn state on hold for more than 2 years. Eto Shinpei was proposing a new civil code and a system of courts to protect the rights of citizens. Education Minister Okita Kato was arguing that Japan urgently needed a unified school system. And Inoue Kaoru of the Finance Ministry was saying that none of these reforms were possible at the moment, while trying to make the yen a unified currency of Japan to avoid a complete depletion of the treasury, which now had to pay the salaries of samurai all over the country. But Saigo's problems were not limited to quarreling officials. By early 1872, Hisamitsu was on a rampage with Satsuma. First, he demanded to be appointed governor of Satsuma. When he realized that this was not going to happen, he switched to complaining that samurai were lowered in social status to commoners, that Western dress hid all differences in status, that women's education was nonsense, and that it was a disgrace to allow marriages between members of different classes. Saigo was shocked and appalled by Hisamitsu's behavior. Once again, he felt that he had betrayed the Shimazu clan, but Hisamitsu's conduct was unacceptable. Furthermore, by this time, Saigo had become a great fan of Emperor Meiji. In a letter to his uncle, he described the young emperor as reliable, earnest, intelligent, and approachable. Saigo was amazed to be invited to dine and discuss politics with the young emperor on three separate occasions within a month. This internal conflict of loyalties came to a head during an imperial visit to southwestern Japan. At first, Saigo was once again impressed by the emperor's character. An amusing episode tells us that Saigo, feeling a great sense of responsibility, snapped at one of his colleagues for a planning error that delayed the emperor's departure from Kumamoto. He then went in the courtyard and took out the rest of his dress on an innocent watermelon. It is said that the emperor watched the whole scene and even got a little splashed with watermelon juice. But instead of being frightened or angry, he found the situation quite funny. The imperial procession then arrived in Kagoshima, where it was greeted with a cannon salute and a military parade. The emperor's meeting with Hisamitsu also seems to have been uneventful. But then Hisamitsu went to complain to one of the emperor's closest men about current politics in general and Saigo in particular. Obviously, he avoided the meeting with Saigo in any possible way. Saigo only found about his former lord's behavior when he returned to Tokyo. And at the end of 1872, he even went to Kagoshima in hopes of calming Hisamitsu, but was, as himself put it, thoroughly disgusted by his lordship's absurd arguments. In one of his letters, he also noted, "The mood of Satsuma is markedly different, and things have deteriorated considerably." Saigo returned to Tokyo from Kagoshima in March 1873, but even here he could only dream of peace. During this time, the conflicts between departments within the government had only intensified, and now there was the problem of Taiwan and Korea to deal with. But Saigo was not particularly interested in them. Much more depressing to him was the extremely old-fashioned procession of samurai with swords and traditional hairstyles that Hisamitsu brought to the capital at the end of April. At this point, Hisamitsu was openly ridiculed by the newspapers, and even Saigo couldn't stand it, calling his antics infantile whims. By early May, the accumulated stress had taken its toll and Saigo began to suffer from heart pains. By June, his condition had deteriorated to the point that the emperor sent his personal physician, Theodor Hoffmann, to see him. Hoffmann diagnosed Saigo with atherosclerosis and ordered him to exercise more, eat less fat, and take strong laxatives regularly. That wonderful European medicine of the 19th century. Saigo began to follow the doctor's prescriptions diligently, even moving from his home in central Tokyo to his brother's house in Shibuya, then a quiet suburb when it was easy to walk in the fields or hunt in the woods. The fresh air soon restored Saigo's strength and spirit, and he even began to wonder if he could supplement his walks with sumo or sword training, but the doctor recommended a less strenuous exercise program. But while Saigo was enjoying the countryside and once again contemplating retirement, the Korean question, long delayed since 1868, came to the forefront. Following further insulting remarks by Korean officials towards Japan, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs refused to quietly tolerate the attacks from its neighbor. The summer of 1873 was thus spent by the provisional government trying to decide whether the Korean problem should be solved peacefully or by force. Saigo was also involved in the discussion, and even today, historians debate Saigo's possible and impossible motives in the Korean conflict and whether he really wanted war or peace. The internal conflict over Korea was indeed an important stage in the process of establishing a new government. Whether it was important to Saigo is a much more open question. There are many ways to interpret his motives and actions, But at this point, I agree with those historians who see Saigo's position on the Korean issue exactly as he described it in his letters. After all, he had already done exactly the same thing twice. First with Chosho, and then with Katsu. Since his first participation in the discussion on the 12th of June, Saigo had expressed the same position. An envoy should be sent to Korea. If they listen to him and ask for forgiveness, all will be well. And if they don't listen and kill him, then Korea is on the side of evil and provoke Japan into conflict. Haven't we seen this before? Of course. And as in all previous cases, Saigo offered himself as an envoy. And he was quite convincing. In a letter to Itagaki, who argued for military intervention, he wrote, "If we send on an official emissary over there, I imagine the Koreans still would kill him, and I beg you to send me. I can't be a fine diplomat like Soejima, but if it is only a matter of dying, I think I can manage. Therefore, I hope you will send me. Please excuse me for being blunt, but I give you this in writing in the hope of your full agreement." In his interactions with Sanjo, who advocated for peaceful resolution of the conflict, he insisted that he would do his best to resolve the conflict without the use of force. And in both cases, he was entirely true to himself. Therefore, the Council on the Korean Question, which met on the 17th of August, approved Saigo for the post. But the emperor asked to postpone the final decision until the return of the Iwakura mission from Europe, and Saigo had to wait. Finally, on the 13th of September, the last and most important member of the mission, Iwakura Tomomi himself, returned to Japan, and in October, the full government resumed its work on the Korean question. Saigo's ardent desire to learn the truth and seek justice made little impression on the members of the Iwakura mission. And the treasury had no money for Korea at the moment, so no one had to go anywhere. When there is funding and at least a rough plan of action, sure, but now is not the time. The opinion of the majority is finally shifted towards rationality by the illness of Sanjo, who couldn't stand the tension and had a nervous breakdown on the 18th of October. Taking his place, Iwakura becomes head of the government, and a few days later announces to Saigo and his supporters that there will be no trip to Korea. The very next day, Saigo resigns and sails from Yokohama to Kagoshima on the 28th of October. Finally, Saigo was truly retired. He spent most of his time in the countryside, soaking in the hot springs, hunting and fishing. Judging from the letters and accounts of his friends and relatives, he was not just relaxing, he was actively avoiding politics. For example, this is how his wife's sister, Iwayama Toku, describes Saigo. "Many people came from Kajiki to visit Saigo at Hinatayama, but for some reason Saigo made no effort to meet them and would often leave to avoid them. It was hard for us since we knew that they had come a long way. When he was alone in the house, he would smoke his long pipe and lose himself in thought, almost as though he was asleep. Now, when I put it all together, I realize that when he was alone in the house, he was quietly thinking about the world. Not that I would presume to know what he was thinking." But even leaving politics behind, Saigo could not abandon the subject of education. He himself studied hard and loved to teach. In the summer of 1873, while still in Tokyo, he opened a school called Shugijuku, to which he sent all of his considerable salary. Saigo believed that he and his fellow government officials, the survivors, did not deserve a reward for what they have done from the bottom of their hearts, but that those who had died should be thanked instead. Therefore, there was no better use of the imperial stipend than to open a school that would honor the memory of those who had died for the emperor and educate future generations by their noble example. When Saigo left Tokyo, the school closed, but was soon reopened in Kagoshima under the name Shoten Gakko. Local children went there to learn foreign languages and Western sciences. Outside of the city, another school, Yoshino Kaikonsha, was built to teach agriculture, husbandry, and land reclamation. Saigo, with his interest and knowledge of rural administration, spent a lot of time there. During the day, he would plant rice, millet, and sweet potatoes with his students, and in the evening he would attend classes on military training and Chinese philosophy. This was Saigo's way of raising the ideal samurai, as he saw them, educated, practical, and self-sufficient. In April 1875, Saigo himself described his life at Yoshino as follows. "These days, I'm a farmer, through and through, and I'm studying earnestly. At first, it was rather difficult, but now I can till about 2 plots a day. I've gotten used to simple foods such as soup with tofu leaves and sweet potato, and so, with no sense of privation and unperturbed by anything, I am at peace." In the same letter, Saigo declined an invitation to go to Europe to follow the development of the conflict between France and Prussia and thanked his cousin for the dog collar, asking him to send 5 or 6 more at the same time. Just a few weeks later, we get more evidence that Saigo has put all his time and energy into his new project. He asks his brother to pay the builders for the work done in Yoshino, orders a large number of tools, and even talks about selling his house in Kagoshima. Saigo probably wanted to leave the city altogether and settle in the countryside. In August, he asks his friend to receive all his mail, to open it, and to tell Saigo only if something really important has arrived. At the same time as the Yoshino school, in Kagoshima and later throughout Satsuma, other schools were opened to channel the energies of young and disaffected samurai in a peaceful direction. A whole system of private schools taught them martial arts and Chinese classics, roughly the same subjects that Saigo and his friends had learned as children as part of their traditional Satsuma education. And that was where the root of the problem seemed to be. While the rest of the country was moving forward, the youths of Satsuma were studying the Chinese classics, and the provincial leadership was avoiding the reforms of the central government. The same distance from the center that had allowed Satsuma to be a progressive province during the Edo period was now helping it to remain in the past. You already know how actively Hisamitsu fought for the past, but he was far from being alone. Oyama Tsunayoshi, the governor of Kagoshima, also supported the old ways. It was he who created the school system described above. Saigo was also involved, but in a very limited way. For the most part, he once again served as a symbol. Somehow, the samurai who opposed the reforms of the new government were not at all bothered by the fact that their hero supported most of the decisions that removed samurai privileges. To them, he remained the guardian of traditional values, and Saigo's resignation from the government was seen by his admirers as a sign that Saigo was against the new policies. Thus, perhaps without even realizing it, Saigo, with his Confucian ideals, became the spiritual leader of the private school students. On the 28th of March 1876, the Meiji government banned the carrying of swords, except for officers at state ceremonies, soldiers, and police. In August of the same year, a new decree was issued, this time requiring all samurai to convert their stipends to 30-year bonds. The opportunity to do this had existed for 3 years already, but there were few willing participants and the government was in constant need of money. The bonds paid an annual interest rate of 5-7%, but for most samurai this whole economic system was completely incomprehensible, and all they could see was that their usual annual income would be reduced by at least 30%. Coming shortly after the sword ban, the decree only added fuel to the fire. The samurai lost the last privileges that had given them some sense of importance. It's safe to say that many of them suffered an identity crisis, which led to a wave of rebellions in the south of the country. Saigo clearly sympathized with the rebels. In November, he wrote to his friend that one such samurai uprising, the Maebara Rebellion, was great news. He was confident that the rebels would soon take Osaka and was only saddened that they had not waited until the emperor's birthday to start the rebellion on the symbolic date. However, Saigo himself was not going to participate in any unrest. He further isolated himself from the world, fearing that his appearance in Kagoshima might be taken as a signal for the action. As he wrote himself, "If I were to hurry back to the city now, I suspect that the young man there would become uncontrollable. I certainly do not intend to let anyone see me behaving intemperately, especially not now. No doubt, if I were to go into action, it would astonish the entire country." Saigo's former colleagues in Tokyo feared exactly the same thing. And when Akubo summoned Governor Oyama to Tokyo to persuade him to align Satsuma's administration with national standards, Oyama confirmed the Meiji government's worst fears. The situation in Kagoshima was so tense and anti-government that any attempt at reform was likely to provoke open resistance. With no help from Oyama, who was perfectly happy with the situation, Okubo sent a subordinate to Kagoshima who spent several months monitoring the situation and reported that nothing short of direct intervention from Tokyo would be able to sway Kagoshima from its chosen path. By January of 1877, the government had decided to remove the arsenal from Kagoshima. It was only logical. The weapons were state property and the arsenals were scattered all over the country. But Kagoshima had the largest ones, and with the situation escalating rapidly, it was better to move the temptation of weapons far away. Unfortunately, this was also the opportunity that the rebellious disgruntled samurai has been waiting for, and they were happy to be provoked. For 5 days at the end of January, they had looted the government armories. Whether the attack was spontaneous or planned, the result was the same. Kagoshima was now in open rebellion against the government. Meanwhile, Saigo was hunting far away from the city in Konejima across the bay. On the 1st of February, he learned of the events in Kagoshima from his brother's letter and immediately set out to investigate the situation himself. On 7th of February, Saigo concluded that he might have been able to prevent the attack on the arsenal, but now that it had happened, there was no turning back. Again, adding fuel to the fire was the fact that spies sent by the national police had been discovered in Kagoshima. Unfortunately, they had a useless leader who told one of Kagoshima's private school students about the mission. The news spread quickly and soon the loose-lipped leader of the spies was caught and tortured. Under torture, he revealed that he had indeed led the spies in Kagoshima and had planned to assassinate Saigo on behalf of the government. Whether this was true or just what the torturer wanted to hear, we don't know. But to the young samurai, and seems like even to Saigo, his testimony was true. So Saigo finally decided to lead the rebellion and go to Tokyo to find out the truth. He also felt responsible for the young samurai, as the school system created with Saigo's help was failing to fulfill its function and channel their energy in a peaceful direction. Satsuma began to prepare for war. That's where all the things taught at school came in handy. The rebel samurai were well versed in modern weaponry and had taken a good number of Schneider and Enfield rifles, various carbines and pistols, as well as swords. Two artillery units collected all the field guns available in Satsuma, including 28 mountain guns and about 30 assorted mortars. Their approximately 1,200-strong army was divided in 7 battalions and had high morale. The rebellion seemed destined for success. But Satsuma's troops had a weakness that no one paid attention to. The army had no supply system for munition and food. Each soldier carried his own rations, and it wasn't clear what to do when they ran out. On 15th of February, under the first real snowfall in 50 years, the rebels left Kagoshima and headed north. The official purpose of the rebellion was to accompany Saigo to the capital to question the Tokyo government. But that was the official and generally overstated purpose. Since Saigo was not going to rebel in the first place, there was no need to accompany him anywhere. Saigo was once again the symbol, the whole that united the various groups of samurai who joined the rebel army for their own reasons. As one member of the rebellion, Kabayama Sukeyami, summed it up, "I thought that if it was Saigo's doing, it might not be a mistake." Thus, Saigo Takamori became a leader of a rebellion that had no purpose. It had a plan, though. The plan was to march on the capital and use the army not to attack, but to intimidate, to force the Meiji government to make the right reforms. And if you think we've seen this before, you are absolutely right. We've seen it in Nariakira's plans, in Hisamitsu's campaign of 1862, and in the coup of 1868. The idea was hardly new. The real war broke out on the 21st of February, when the rebels came very close to Kumamoto Castle. 2 days later, they attacked the castle itself, but on the second day of fighting, they realized that it would not surrender so easily and laid siege to it. Ironically, an army of samurai fighting to preserve tradition, armed with modern firearms, or the army of the new government, whose main advantage in battle was a 17th century samurai castle. As Saigo's forces lay siege to the castle, a wave of mini rebellions by peasants and samurai against the new government sweeps across the island of Kyushu. All of them, like the rebel groups in the main army, had their own reasons, and Saigo's lack of clear goal gave each a chance to find their own. The siege of Kumamoto Castle, however, was not only an event that attracted rebels' numerous supporters, but also the point that marked the beginning of the end of the Satsuma Rebellion. The Imperial Army had 45,000 soldiers, more than 100 cannons, and, most importantly, an uninterrupted supply of food and ammunition. And the longer the castle stood, the more of these forces could reach Kumamoto to crush the rebellion. And that's exactly what happened. On the 3rd of March, the rebels fought a long and hard battle with the imperial troops on the road leading to the castle and a place called Tabaruzaka. And on the 9th of March, the imperial army landed in Kagoshima and took control of all the weapons in the city. On the 20th of March, the imperial troops finally took the position at Tabaruzaka and continued to push the rebels back to Kumamoto. And on the 15th of April, an army advancing from the south defeated another rebel position and lifted the siege of Kumamoto Castle. And so, the long retreat of the rebel army began. From mid-April to the end of March, they defended positions at Hitoyoshi, south of Kumamoto, and during the summer, the imperial army hunted the remaining rebel groups across the whole island of Kyushu. Of course, the plans to march on Tokyo were all but over. What's more, the rebels were running out of ammunition, and simply abandoned their rifles and pistols in favor of good old-fashioned samurai swords, which didn't need reloading. Saigo also made a good run across the island, but by mid-August he was surrounded with a small force in Nobeoka, in the north of modern Miyazaki Prefecture. The attack on August 18th seemed to bring the war to an end. But the next day, it appeared that Saigo and several of his companions had escaped yet again. Less than 2 weeks later, on the 1st of September, Saigo's remaining forces suddenly appeared in Kagoshima. Due to the chaotic nature of the retreat, historians have no reliable written sources about the events. Therefore, while some witnesses claim that Saigo was ill and had difficulty moving due to his worsening illness, others say that he was healthy and cheerful and regularly hunted in the mountains. The only thing we know for sure is that by August, Saigo had realized that the rebellion had no hope of success. And so, the rebels in Kagoshima were preparing to die. They had virtually no food or ammunition, no medicine and no doctor, and the Imperial Army was standing just below Mount Shiroyama, where the remaining 300 samurai had set up camp. Accepting the inevitable death, the rebels enjoyed a mountainous view of their native Kagoshima Bay with a smoking volcano in its center, exchanged poems and played go. On 22nd of September, Saigo told his followers that the next battle would be their last and urged them to fight without fear or regret. On the 23rd, Saigo received a legendary letter from Yamagata Aritomo, commander of the Imperial Army and his former colleague. And while historians are unsure if this letter even existed, we have access to its full text, in which Yamagata tearfully implores Saigo to end his resistance and save the soldiers' lives, which would be wasted in a battle with predetermined outcome. According to tradition, Saigo read the letter in silence and informed the envoy that there would be no reply. At 3:55 the following morning, and this is already a fact, the Imperial Army launched its final attack. By 5:30, they had destroyed the rebels' defenses, and at 7 o'clock, Saigo and about 40 surviving samurai began to descend the hill to meet their death in battle. About halfway down, Saigo took a bullet that passed through his pelvis and left thigh. According to tradition, he then sat down in ceremonial pose, turned to his comrade Beppu and said, "Shinsuke-don, kokorahen de yo ka, kaishak o tanomos." "I think this place will do. Please be my kaishaku." Bowed towards the Imperial Palace and plunged his sword into his stomach. At Saigo's request, Beppu immediately cut off his head and gave it to Saigo's servant to hide it from the approaching army. A vibrant end to a vibrant life, thought the creators of the greatest myth about Saigo, one so rooted in historical tradition that it has penetrated even school textbooks and academic literature. In reality, however, Saigo's death was far from a ready-made scene of a drama production. Given the nature of the injury, Saigo either passed out immediately from the pain or a little later from a blood loss. The official report tells us, "Saigo Takamori, clothing, light yellow striped unlined kimono, dark blue leggings. Wounds, head separated from body, bullet wound from right hip passing through to the left femur, old sword wound in right ulna, dropsy of the scrotum." The official report is also confirmed by the descriptions of eyewitnesses. Army accountant Kawaguchi Takesada writes very clearly and concisely, "Saigo Takamori, shot through the hip, head missing, later recovered." John Cappen Hubbard, captain of the ship assisting the Imperial force, wrote about his experience in much more detail. He watched the final battle from the deck of his ship and arrived on the scene shortly after the rebels were defeated. In a letter to his wife, he wrote, "When we arrived, we found 8 bodies laid out in 2 rows. The first was Saigo. He was a large, powerful-looking man, his skin almost white. His clothing had been taken off and he lay there naked. It was a few seconds before I realized his head was cut off. Next to Saigo lay Kirino, then Murata. Saigo's was the only headless body, but the others were a fearful sight to look at. Their heads were dreadfully cut up, and it was quite evident that they killed each other. No doubt their heads would all have been cut off by their own people had time permitted. While looking at the bodies, Saigo's head was brought in and placed by his body. It was a remarkable looking head, and anyone would have said at once that he must have been the leader. As you can see, there were no sword wounds on Saigo's body, and even in the unlikely event that he didn't lose consciousness shortly after being wounded, he simply wouldn't have been able to sit in a pose for ritual suicide. I feel Mark Ravina has described this just perfectly in his book. Because Saigo had come to represent samurai valor, his death had to represent samurai tradition. Physiology notwithstanding, tradition demanded that Saigo sit on a shattered hip and serenely ask Beppu to help him die. Saigo had become a legend, and the Japanese media decided to print the legend, not the man. The next day, news of Saigo's death appeared in the newspapers. And while the state press wrote, Saigo's last battle was not just the end of Saigo, but the battle announcing the end of feudal power, others compared him to the ancient Japanese hero Kusunoki Masashige, famous Chinese generals, and even Napoleon. Each of these stories had its own readers. People even believed stories that Saigo was alive and hiding abroad. Thanks to the newspapers, he visited China and Korea, India and Russia. And in 1891, Russian Crown Prince Nicholas would pay for the gullibility of the Japanese public. While traveling in Japan, he was attacked by Tsuda Sanzo, a veteran of the Satsuma Rebellion. Nicholas received 2 wounds to the head and was forced to leave Japan in a hurry. This was because Tsuda believed that Saigo had returned to Japan with the Russian prince, endangering all his military regalia. But Saigo's adventures didn't even end there. In 1889, he was pardoned and even given a court rank. And in 1898, the famous statue of Saigo appeared in Tokyo's Ueno Park. The same 1890s saw the birth of modern Bushido in Japan, which was soon to become a national ideology. The idea that samurai traditions constituted Japan's national heritage instantly elevated Saigo to a new level of honor. He now became the embodiment of the samurai code of honor, an example of Bushido, the last samurai that the Japanese militarists of the early 20th century sought so dearly. And so ends our acquaintance with Saigo Takamori, the man who created the new Japan and straightened it with his actions against the new government. A legendary man filled with all kinds of meanings by his admirers and still one of the most beloved historical figures of the Japanese. For the most curious listeners, I'll add a link to the article about how Japanese artists have depicted Saigo, his life, his death, and even his existence on Mars. And for the rest of you, don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Talk to you soon. Bye!
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.